just suffocates us with enough death-dealing in this world that I think we might need a reprieve every now and then, especially when we gather together in this sanctuary. Plus, there are a lot of problems on the more immediate home front, emotional, psychological, philosophical, that also require our investigation. So here is an alternative message, and a different message at that. There was once a boy who had a magical bell on his bicycle. Every time he rang it, he'd be whisked away into a strange land of excitement and adventure. One day he returned home from a particularly exciting adventure from the strange land and realized that the library would shut in 15 minutes. If I don't get my books back to the library today, I'll be fine, he thought. So he jumped on his bicycle with the magical bell and set off. On the way, he had to stop at some traffic lights that had turned red. Oh no, he thought, I'll be late. Just as the lights were about to change, a little girl walked by. She said, "You're ever so famous. Please, may I have your autograph?" So the boy with the bicycle bell had to write her his name down in her autograph book. And by the time he had done so, the lights were back to red. "If I hurry, I might still make it," he said to himself as he waited. A little further along the road, a man leaped out and took a photograph. The boy with the bicycle bell was completely surprised. The bright flash from the camera stopped his eyes from working for a few moments, then he crashed into a litter bin. "Thanks," said the photographer. "I work for a newspaper, and this picture will look splendid next to the story of your latest adventure." The boy with the bicycle bell stood up, straightened the handlebar on his bicycle, and sped off. "If I really, really hurry, I may still get there before they close," he hoped. Suddenly, an old lady walked out in front of him. Now, how she got to be old with an attitude to road safety like that, the boy with the bicycle belt didn't know. He was going to hit her if she didn't spot him. He reached for his bicycle bell, then realizing that ringing it would send him off to that strange land where spoons dance and the sky is red, he said, "Look out!" "Hey," she replied moments before the boy with the bicycle bell knocked her over. By the time he finished explaining everything to the policeman, the library had been shut for half an hour. Now, even though the author Richard A. Bartle suggests that the moral goes something like, don't trust anything magical unless it has an off switch, I think there are several more significant lessons we can learn from this short fiction, besides the more obvious, you know, best laid plans speech. Namely, that we shouldn't let vain distractions get in the way of our goals, and that we'd be better off prioritizing what really matters in life and not stressing over the little things. For instance, I might first say to that boy, remember what's important. Don't stop for the autograph or the photo op. Keep pressing forward. Secondly, and somewhat contrarily, I might even say, don't worry about those books. There is an alternative. Go tomorrow, pay the fine, and relish in the thrill of your adventure just a bit longer. Meditate on it. Reflect and process it. After all, who knows when you'll next have time to escape, even if it is just the ring of a bell away. The ring of a bell, the push of a button. You see, the boy's ultimate dilemma correlates all too well to the narratives we ourselves weave, especially in the summertime, or whenever it is we just get back from a vacation, or even a mission trip, for that matter. Because what seems to always happen, if you're anything like me or the boy, is that the sensation of living, and I mean truly living, that comes from an exciting adventure to a strange area, it dries up like the morning dew, when reality sinks in and we're summoned back to the homebound grind, back to toil more than we did before we escaped. And worse, we toil to such great lengths when we are still relatively young that we sacrifice our own health. Also, we can have enough money when we are old to then pay premiums on health care. Vanity of vanities, all is vanity. In season one of the television show Lost, and in the episode Hearts and Minds, the character John Locke is approached by the character Boone. Boone notices that Locke is once again just sitting and staring at the hatch door that he found buried in the ground, just as he's been doing so for several weeks now. Boone then asks him the obvious, if he ever intends to get to work, to toil a little, to actually do something about that door, or does he need to simply stare at it forever? Locke replies, Ludovico Buonarroti, Michelangelo's father. He was a wealthy man. He had no understanding of the divinity in his son, so he beat him. No child of his was going to use his hands for a living. So Michelangelo learned to not use his hands. Well, years after, a visiting prince came into Michelangelo's studio and found the master staring at a single 18-foot block of marble. And he knew the rumors were true, that Michelangelo had come in every day for the last 4 months doing nothing but stare at that marble, and then he went home for his supper. So one day the prince asked the obvious, what are you doing just sitting and staring there? And Michelangelo turned and looked at him and whispered, Sto lavorando. I'm working. 3 years later, that block of marble became the statue of David. Now, your guess is as good as mine if any of that's historically true. It probably isn't. But does it matter? Doesn't it at least sound good? Moreover, doesn't it preach that much can be done while yet still? That through seemingly doing nothing at all, enlightenment can yet be reached? When I was a teenager, I seemed to grasp this. Back then, I seemed to better understand. My parents, my mom, can attest that one day I told them that I wanted nothing more in life than to be an old man, sitting in a lawn chair, waving at cars as they drove by and greeting strangers on the street. I'm not kidding. That's all I wanted. There was a guy in our neighborhood who did that, and it just seemed so liberating. sitting around feels to me like a day wasted. Like the boy with the bicycle power turning his books, there's simply too much that distracts me, too much that I need to do. And so I try to cram it all in as little of time as possible. I live, I breathe, I function by what my calendar tells me to do. I say yes to things I know I shouldn't. And I often toil away at meaningless tasks sitting behind screens until my eyes are weary and bloodshot. Am I alone? Or does this sound also a bit like you? And usually at the end of my day, mostly I mean my free days, I wonder just where all the time went and what precisely I accomplished. Sure, I got out of the house. I went to A, I went to B, I got to C, and I got to D, and I crossed all those things off my list, but in the end, what for? The sun rises and the sun sets, and I'm back in bed again with a pit in my stomach, thinking it's all just slipping away, flying by, and I'm not really doing anything at all. I'm not ringing any bells. I'm just killing time. And even though I'm self-aware and attuned to it, perhaps evident in this sermon, I yet can hardly avoid it. So many of my days are interrupted like that old lady in our first tale. She ain't moving out of my way, and I can't swerve in time. But really, what alternative do I have? Things have to get done, don't they? Bills need to get paid. Vincent needs to get bought. My son Seth needs to be fed, etc., etc., etc. And this mindset, this reality, it even disrupts my marriage. Austin confessed something to you last week, so I guess this week it's my turn. Next week it's Cindy's. I confess that I often perceive I'm the only one in my house doing something. Have you also felt this way? Yes, behind the scenes of the photos I post of our beautiful little family, we're not perfect. We're not perfect at all. In fact, what I really mean to say is that I'm not perfect. I am a pain to live with. I am not easy to live with. I get bothered when Anya chews her apples too loudly. My son Seth's screaming at night can frustrate me to no end. I can't stand being late to an event or walking into our messy house, and I get visibly agitated when Anya appears to be contributing to both, or so I perceive. Like Martha, I sometimes look upon my wife as she did Mary, and I whisper, Lord, do you not care that my wife has left me all this work to do by myself? And I dare to say that. And I dare to think that. Even though she does more than her fair share, especially with our son. Sometimes I come downstairs and my wife is kind of just like staring. Like Michelangelo at that marble. In her case, she's either staring into our son's eyes or somewhere off in the distance, and I think that's it. She's finally dreaming of getting away from me. But really what she's doing, so she tells me, is meditating. Approaching peace, bliss, enlightenment. And she gets there, she says, by being still. By doing nothing. By sitting in silence at the foothold of the universe, listening and attempting to discern how it wishes to guide her that day and going forward. If not for her grace, I could have made a real mess of things already, for now I can truly see that the stupid little things that I used to get so bent out of shape about, they never mattered at all. They will never matter at all. Not even the flea's breath of the entire universe will they matter at all. Instead of me, the minister, it's been my Buddhist wife who's figured it out. Instead of Martha, it was Mary who figured it out. And they're better off for it. those quiet